You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Anthony Richter. I'm the Associate Director of the Open Society Foundations. And in that capacity, I oversee things, the work of the Open Society, Afghanistan, which is an affiliated partner of ours based in Kabul. A word about the foundation, which is set up several years ago. It has an Afghan staff, and it's overseen by an Afghan advisory board, and of which Nader Nadiri is the chairman. And we are primarily engaged with building the capacity of civil society in that country. We're very fortunate today to have two distinguished speakers who I'll introduce in a moment. And we're taking advantage of the release about 2 weeks ago of a report of the Century Foundation's International Task Force on Afghanistan, being referred to also as the Brahimi Pickering Report, called Afghanistan Negotiating Peace. And our other speaker was a member of this task force. Let me begin by giving a little introduction of the two speakers. First, Francesc Vendrell is a very well-known, distinguished member of the international community's civil service, working in for many, many years with the United Nations. He was the director of the Asia Pacific Division at the Department of Political Affairs in the UN. He's also been the UN Secretary General Special Representative of, in Afghanistan, particularly in that crucial last couple of years when the Taliban were in power and left power, and made a very important contribution at that time and subsequently for a number of years as the European Union Special Representative for Afghanistan. He's currently dividing his time between London and the Johns Hopkins, the School of Advanced International Studies Center in Bologna. To his right is Ahmad Nader Nadiri, who's the a commissioner of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission. He also chairs the Free and Fair Election Foundation of Afghanistan, called FIFA, and serves as the chairman of the advisory board, as I said, of the Open Society Foundation. He has represented Afghan peace activists in the UN peace talks for Afghanistan in the Bonn Conference in 2001. I think it's fair to say that presence of voices like his at Bonn was one of the many ways that Ambassador Vendrell left an indelible and valuable mark on the way in which diplomacy was carried out at the time. So those are our speakers. We have before us a report which is a point of departure. I think we'll stay with the report for a while and some of its recommendations, but not be hostage to the report and be limited to the report and its recommendations as the sole framework for the conversation today. I think it's fair to say that the conflict in Afghanistan, which has been going on for more than 30 years, And the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan for now almost 10 has reached or is about to reach a critical turning point. I think it's widely recognized, at least by the United States, which provides most of the resources and the fighting forces from the international community in the conflict, that the present situation is no longer tenable. In fact, in July, the surge launched by President Obama will begin a drawdown phase. At this point, 64% of Americans no longer believe that the war in Afghanistan is worth the cost, whether in dollars or in lives. Despite General Petraeus's suggestion that his testimony and assertion that the surge is working, its impact may only be temporary, and intended to create a space for a political solution. And that's where the Century Foundation Task Force report comes into the picture. I'm not going to summarize its findings. It's best done by our speakers. And so with that, maybe Ambassador Ventrell, I'll give you the floor for 10 minutes, and as you will. So thank you very much. We're very honored that you joined us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to come to the Open Society Institute, for which I have a great deal of time and which has been doing very valuable work, not only in Afghanistan, but in so many other parts of the world. It's even a greater pleasure to be with Nader Naderi, who is a very good friend and who is one of the best Afghans I've ever known, and whom we have not supported enough throughout, whom we, meaning governments, have not supported enough, nor have they supported enough the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission, which is one of the many failures that the international community has committed in Afghanistan over the past 10 years. And it is because of the many failures about which, as you know, Nader, I warned against, and I feared that we were going down the road, the wrong road, almost from the very beginning of the since the Bonn Conference. And perhaps I should quickly summarize the mistakes. The mistakes included supporting the warlords and commanders from the very beginning, allowing them to become governors and police chiefs and ministers across the country, the very people who had ruined the country in the 90s and who had opened the door to the Taliban because of their misrule, their corruption, and their crimes. And we failed to ensure that the government of Afghanistan would have the monopoly on the means of violence. So from the beginning, we had corruption, we've had bad governance, and we have not paid enough attention to rule of law institutions, instead always concentrating on the armed forces, which, of course, though important, is certainly not enough. There have been many others. I will not go into it because this is not the purpose of this meeting. So I'm going to mention what are the main recommendations of this panel established by the Century Foundation, of which I was a member. And I agree. I'm going to mention them in a moment. I agree with them. Of course, being a member of a panel doesn't mean one agrees with everything. But on the whole, I agree with heavy heart. Heavy heart because I didn't think it would be necessary to recommend that one should begin talks with the Taliban as soon as possible. There was no need to reach that point, but it's over the last 3 or 4 years, it's become clear that the international community has does not have the political will, as it did not have the political will, to ensure good governance in Afghanistan, to ensure an end to impunity, to ensure a significant decrease in corruption, and therefore, in this kind of situation, of course, the Western public has been increasingly keen to disengage. Disengage because they see no end to the military activities, and at the same time, we appear to be supporting a government that the Afghans don't seem to like, and that our public opinion doesn't seem to like either. So for these reasons, this is what I'll outline the main recommendations of the report. We believe that time for talks with the Taliban is now. The sooner the sooner we start the talks, the better. The longer they are delayed, these talks, the higher price we will have to pay to restore peace. Involvement of neighboring countries, by which we mean in particular Pakistan, Iran, India, and to a lesser degree also the Central Asian Republics, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, the involvement of neighboring countries as well as other key interested parties, meaning the US, the European Union, and of course the UN, will be essential for any talks to succeed. The third point would be there needs to be a political strategy behind the current military strategy. In my view, there has been no political strategy since the very beginning, and I'm very disappointed to have to say that I don't think the Obama administration has produced a political strategy either. It has left policy in the hands of the generals. Any military gains that may well be happening now are likely to be short-lived. We are faced, in other words, with a military stalemate. There is a danger that the ISAF strategy that General Petraeus is so keen on, of killing as many mid-level Taliban commanders as possible, will only weaken the chain of command between the so-called Quetta Shura, that's where the Taliban command in Pakistan is based, or at least that's the way we call it, that the more mid-level commanders you kill, the more likely it is the junior people will join in, more extreme than their predecessors and less willing to listen to a decision taken by the leadership for a political solution. There is no mechanism at the moment or structure for serious talks between the government of Afghanistan and Taliban. President Karzai talks a lot about it, about talks. In fact, as I used to say already some years ago, this is a unique case where so much talking about talking is taking place with so little real talking, when in most cases one does not one hides the fact that there are talks, but then talks are taking place. But there is no serious mechanism or structure. There is a high peace council that President Karzai established, but we do not believe that this is in itself an appropriate body to carry out any talks with the Taliban. Now, therefore, in this situation, we also believe that that public support for us. You mentioned earlier public support in Europe and in the United States is waning, and that in Afghanistan the international military presence is increasingly resented. We also believe that power, and partly this is the fault of the West, but power has been unnecessarily concentrated in one person in Kabul, and that you need to spread out power both at the national level and at the subnational. We think that it would be a good idea for the Secretary General of the UN, preferably for the Secretary General of the UN, to appoint a special envoy who would be tasked with an exploration task. he would or she would explore whether conditions exist for a dialogue with the Taliban and for the involvement of the neighbors. It means that he or she would travel to the neighbors, to other key interested countries, and also would talk to a variety of Afghan actors, including, of course, the Taliban and the government, but also, of course, including other actors like parliament and civil society. And perhaps the report does not stress that enough. If he, as a result of these exploratory meetings, he feels that there is a possibility of having some successful negotiations, then I think he should recommend what kind of a structure should be established for such talks and what procedures should be followed. Now, we believe that UNAMA, which is the UN presence, the UN mission in Afghanistan, has a job to do in the meantime, and the job to do in particular, that has many other things to do as well, is to encourage or support a national dialogue inside Afghanistan to explore the views of the population across the country and find out what price are Afghans. We know Afghans are keen on peace, but we don't know what price they're willing to pay. What should be the concessions that they would be willing to make, and wouldn't be these concessions. We believe that if and when an agreement is arrived at, we believe that perhaps a solution might be also to have a non-aligned Afghanistan with mutual security guarantees between Afghanistan and its neighbors, with an endorsement which would be endorsed by the UN Security Council. We certainly believe that the government of Afghanistan in the meantime would strengthen its position if it improved governance, limited corruption, and enhanced rule of law in the country. And we feel that if and when a political settlement was arrived at, the international community, and particularly the West, should not opt out. Then it should continue its involvement in a different capacity, in training, in capacity building, in state building, in reconstruction and in development. And we think, of course, that the current U.S.-led military force should be replaced by a U.N. peacekeeping force. And that's, in a nutshell, I think, what the report says or intends to say. And I doesn't mention, but I also would say, that the establishment of militias, the constant, not only have we not got rid of the warlords and their militias, what we've been doing in the last two, or the U.S. has been doing over the last two, and NATO has been doing over the past two or three years, has been to establish new militias in the south, which either new warlords, who either will join the Taliban if they feel that that's the likely, they are the likely winners, or will battle the Taliban even for control of parts of the country, even after an agreement has been arrived at. Thank you.
Very much, Nader.
Thank you, Anthony. It's always a pleasure and a privilege to share a table with you, Ambassador Vendral, and always glad to be here at the Open Society with colleagues and some known faces and friends. And when we are looking to the issues and the debates generally internationally about Afghanistan, both in the international media and also hearing from the policymakers, both here when in our visits or when they visit Afghanistan. We get mixed messages all the time. And these mixed messages are creating a level of debate back home in Afghanistan, both through the local media and in the both academia and political circles, which is very much focused and grounded on this timeline of the drawdown or withdrawal, June, July this year, and the new timeline of 2014. That was decided by NATO member states and also the Afghan government that there will be a full transition of responsibility to the Afghan forces. So we Afghans, we most of the population, both in rural and urban, they are looking to these debate and discussion and the messages they're receiving, creating a mix of a feeling and a sense for an opportunity, but also a sense of an anxiety, and also they are looking to that possible risks that it may have with that and will be associated to come with the transition and with this debate. Opportunity because everybody is in that agreement that this insecurity needed to be removed, and it can't be removed only by political means, by military means, sorry. There must be and there should be some political approaches to be explored to address some of the grievances and some of the issues that exist that contributes to the continuation of violence in Afghanistan. But they look to that only as an opportunity if it is encompassing and sequenced in such that brings number of other measures before embarking in cutting a deal or embarking in a process of reconciliation. As Mr. Venrel referred to, people on the ground do not see that the first thing they must to do is cutting a deal with the Taliban. They say this should be an essential part of a process that first allows space and focuses more on good governance, on rule of law, and establishing a level of justice, giving certain guarantees that any talks that's going to be pursued is going to be pursued from a position of strength for the sake of securing and ensuring that the gains that were made in the last 10 years are going to be protected, for the Bill of Rights chapter of the Constitution to be protected, for the rights of women to be protected and not to be compromised. So if measures are taken in that way, that reconciliation comes part of these bigger package, not reconciliation itself, a political package, then people see it as an opportunity. Because there are major challenges, and that requires and demands more attention when we move forward. The inadequate institutionalization. We have a national army, which to a level is gaining trust and confidence of people, but their numbers are very small, and it requires more investment, it requires more time. Not a rapid expansion of that would end to the expense of its quality. And also national police and other security apparatus, and also the civil service institutions that requires more of work. So inadequate institutionalization is a major challenge. The second major challenge for any kind of a talk that's going to be successful to be pursued is the insurgent sanctuaries. That most of the time being ignored by those international debates and in the international debates about Afghanistan. You cannot deal with Taliban and with their Al-Qaeda elements in Afghanistan if we do not focus properly and deal properly with the insurgent sanctuaries at the other side of the Afghan border. And third, the human development, and especially the social and political mobilization of people. When we talk about the transition by 2014, the entire focus, as Mr. Venrel rightly pointed to, is on how security responsibility could be transferred, while there is no discussion about how human capacity and human development be pursued also, so enables Afghanistan on the civilian side to take responsibility and to stand on its feet. One of the very few visions that people share with President Karzai is his statement very recently at the Afghan New Year on 22nd of March, said that we want Afghanistan to stand on its feet. but not alone. So not standing on its feet, but not alone, is something that's shared across Afghanistan. Everybody agrees on that. And that not being alone means that we need to be supported and helped and mentored, not only on security side, but on civilian side, so our institution can operate, our civilian sector can deliver services that they are needing. Now, the risks that people do see in a premature reconciliation, mostly in a format of just cut a deal, and that's the time, cut a deal and go ahead, and especially from a position of weakness, both from an Afghan government perspective that is not able to reach out to its district levels and to connect with people and provide services, and also from the international community perspective. Yes, the surge have made significant changes and changed number of places in terms of security, but those are not going to be sustained if proper measures are not going to be taken. And the Taliban takes this drawdown, the debate about withdrawal, countries have pulled out, as a sign of weakness. They say we can stick into our thing, we can continue being violent, and in a couple of years we're going to get the entire thing in a state of, by 2014, in a state of just going and sharing something or being submitting, as the way it's now portrayed, to the Afghan government. And we see that kind of cutting of a deal that will not only undermine the gains that are made in the last 9 years, which are made in the huge cost of blood and treasure, both of the Afghans and also of its international partners. So it's kind of a betrayal to the core of that commitment if we go prematurely, cut a deal, to the core of the strategy that President Obama here laid and the rest of international community bought it, and the UN also have agreed upon, to make sure the core of the strategy that announced by President Obama is to make sure that the Taliban are not returning to power. Through a premature cutting of a deal or a reconciliation that are not sequenced properly and that is going to be done from a position of weakness, it's going to be a return of the Taliban and a Talibanization process, because the other political institutions and political processes are not strengthened properly. So it can't be in a position to challenge that kind of a mentality. But what people want is a fair reconciliation, a reconciliation that has voices of the people, has a process of bottom-up, includes the voices of the victims, guarantees the rights, and guarantees a process of justice. If I may, Ambassador Vendrell, the report, the way I found it, rightly points to the issue that Afghans, both in rural area, the villages, and in the urbans, have a consensus and have an agreement that they want to protect and promote the rights and freedoms that they have gained, be it in terms of the issues of girls' education and women participation and others. But what my read is that it does not present a way forward to that, of protection and guaranteeing it, but rather talks about those justice and human rights issues as the blocking stones for a process of making deal. If the thinking be in such that emphasizing on peace, justice, on justice and human rights and democratic values can be pursued, can be seen as or perceived as a blocking stone, then it will be easier when we negotiate from a position of weakness to compromise over those values. Therefore, reaching to a conclusion that we are the surge of brought to a level of the situation where there's a stalemate, and we need to use that and go and cut a deal, is not something that people would see that will give us a way forward in terms of a successful long-term stability and reconciliation, unless we try to take on board number of changes in the way that the military structure and the military operations are carried out in the last at least 9 months. I was in Oruzgan, I was in Helmand, I was in Kandahar. In all of those three main insurgency spots, the Taliban operations a year ago when I was in Kandahar after dark, my team and the security people would not allow me to go. They would take me to a guest house and would say, you're not allowed to go out. But this year, I could go out without any fear. And people were on the street after dark. In Oruzgan, the same thing. In Helmand, in Lashkargah province, where a year ago, people could not open their gates after the dark was coming, even if somebody was at the other side of the gate and knocking. But few months ago, an Afghan singer celebrity, which nobody could imagine that we will have a concert, a live concert, and there will be in a stadium, and there will be 20,000 people in Lashkargah in that stadium, and all night the singer will perform. And it was broadcasted live throughout the national channels, and people were watching it both with interest but with a level of fear that if something happened, nothing happened, and that is an indication that things have changed. Taliban not anymore have the same level of ability to organize, to run operations the way they were doing it. But they have submitted to other tactics, attacking purely and clearly identifiable civilian targets, attacking in a bank. The images also hit the international headlines also, and killing civilians and attacking a sport stadium, attacking a number of other places. So these are the ways that they have tried to target, change their tactic. So that shows there is a change in terms of their ability. So it's not an stalemate. We can invest on civilian side, on good governance, on rule of law, bringing back people with the government. And then there is more incentive for the Taliban, those elements who are accepting the framework, to come and join. There are a number of assumptions that needs to be addressed. Probably that the time may not allow me, but I would take a few of them if I still have a couple of minutes. One assumption is that the current situation is similar to the Soviet time, and there are those factions that were participated in the Soviet Union and the conflict at that time are today again intensely engaged in this process, and the international forces are seen or perceived or try to be portrayed by some similar to what at the Soviet time was. It makes number of that kind of assumption makes number of very very I would call faulty conclusions. Among them, comparing this conflict with the Soviet, as I said, because the nature of today's conflict is entirely different. The instruments that are used and the stakes that are there are very much different. To just name few of them, the intense U.S.-Iranian rivalry is something that plays it out here in today's Afghan conflict, where it was not something like the Soviet time. Second, Indian-Pakistani rivalry also is a contributing factor. There is a commercialized nature of violence there that was not to that extent in the past. Both insurgency and instability itself has become a lucrative a business. It has turned to a profitable enterprise. Most of these kind of assumptions that puts the Soviet time and today to the same time simply ignores that there is an economic and financial dimension to this conflict. But most importantly, they ignore the fact that Afghans have a clear understanding of the international participation, both military and otherwise, in Afghanistan, which is much more different from the Soviet time. They know that this intervention is based on a UN Security Council resolution and a UN-approved process. And they know that it's not indiscriminate bombardment of entire villages. Yes, civilian casualties are there. There is a level of skepticism about the way these forces are operating, but it's not entirely similar. The second major assumption that is there, it's mostly said that at the national level, a political order acceptable to Afghans will need to be negotiated. It's mostly, say, a political order is needed to be there, and Afghans need to develop that. First, most of the time, the international analysts try to, when they say an Afghan solution to be there, they always talk about the Afghan government and the alliance around the Afghan government, which are, unfortunately, bad guys, most of them warlords. And the other side, they talk about Taliban. So these two need to come together and make an alliance. Some go much further and say, let's have the same factions and groups out there and include the Taliban and have them talk. And that's perceived as the Afghan way of finding a political order. They ignore, like it wasn't, as Mr. Venjel pointed in the bone, was a failure to address that. They ignore that in the last 9 years, there is an entire new generation of people who are on board, who are looking for a new future for the country, and they want a different path forward. There's different political actors. Those ugly faces of the civil war that are now part of the government also, and the other side, need not to be considered only players. And in any calculation, the voices of civil society, the voices of what I would call the forces of moderation that is much more stronger now in Afghanistan, need to be a dominant part of any process or any political order. But now coming to this assumption of if the Taliban are motivated by a desire to create a political order, I think it's not at all something that they want. This war, at best, is about domination. Taliban wants a domination. We've seen the way in areas that they have controlled, the stoning of women, application of their way of Sharia law, it still continues. They accept no partnership, as they did the same at the time of their rule. So it's not about a political order, but rather a domination. They don't have a desire to be included. Some of them, the space were open for them. They came and participated in elections. The famous foreign minister of Taliban, which is known as the most moderate one, Mullah Wakil Ahmad Mutawakkil, is for long in Kabul, and the former ambassador and others of Taliban, they ran for office. They couldn't make a vote, but they are still in there. If other members of Taliban wanted to be included in a political order, they would have come and utilized the opportunity. Some of them, like Mullah Rakhiti, who was a very strong Taliban commander, came, accepted to be included in the political order, was elected into the parliament. So that's also something of a wrong assumption. I may stop here, but welcome question. I see Anthony was. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. I thought maybe we would I'd start with a question or two of my own. I saw Ambassador Vendrell taking notes. I assume maybe he would also like to ask some questions from Nader. But I think one of you've touched on it a bit both, but there's an assumption that because, say, the international backers of the conflict right now are ready to negotiate, that this means that the Taliban are also ready to come to the peace talks, to come to the table. But in a certain sense, you know, they could just wait. The deadline has now been announced. It was then, in a way, kind of pushed back again until 2014. Why would the Taliban negotiate now when they can just sit back and wait for these forces to disappear and then pluck the capital for their taking at a time that they choose? Maybe this is a simplistic question.
No, it's not a it's not a simplistic question, and it calls into. I mean, the problem here is, was it wise to mention a deadline? And of course, President Obama was torn, I think, between two publics. One was the Afghan public, and definitely for the Afghan public and for the Taliban in particular, mentioning any date was not a good thing, and particularly not when it eventually began to sound not like the target date, but like a deadline. Of course, domestically, he had to. There were good reasons for mentioning some kind of date, so that people didn't think that the U.S. was going to remain engaged militarily in Afghanistan forever. But it is a problem, and yes, I agree that it could well be that the Taliban may decide to wait us out. But this is why the report is not necessarily saying that we will talk and the Taliban are ready and to talk and we will then find a perfect solution. What the report is basically saying is it's time to explore seriously whether they are inclined to talk, whether there are reasons why they may want to talk, and in particular, what is the position of Pakistan. Now, there are those, and I don't know it firsthand, who claim, but knowing, as I used to know, the Taliban in when they were in power, there are those who believe the Taliban leadership in Quetta, particularly what I would call the leadership under Mullah Omar, are chafing under Pakistani control, and that they would like to find a way out. Now, this, of course, presupposes, and again, the report is not clear enough because it tries to be diplomatic, is how do you on the one side, you keep Pakistan on board, you keep you involve Pakistan, and yet prevent Pakistan from dominating a dialogue among various Afghan groups. And this is why the report at some point suggest the possibility of a Taliban liaison office in a third country, so that there would be some level of independence from the intelligence services. But I want to make it clear that what this is saying is enough of talking about talks, let's be a little bit serious and let's start an exploratory process. Now, you're absolutely right in many of the comments you made. I opposed in Bonn the term Afghan-led process. I thought it was the wrong term because, as I said in Bonn, what do we mean by an Afghan process? A process led by self-appointed Afghan leaders, or eventually later on, a process appointed by legitimate representatives of the Afghans. This hasn't happened. And yes, there is a danger that there would be those who would say that. The problem is, Nader, is a lot of the points you made are absolutely valid. And you're certainly right in saying that there are probably more spoilers now than in the past. It may suit Iran, India, Pakistan, for the U.S. and NATO to remain engaged militarily in Afghanistan with no one winning or losing. It may also satisfy quite a number of Afghan players who are making a hell of a lot of money and have a lot of power as a result of the conflict. But at the same time, my fear is, knowing from experience how Western politicians are, that if we don't seize an opportunity, a moment, that slowly they are already beginning to say the Afghans are not ready for democracy. They are, they are unsuited. They will always be a tribal system. You know the points they are making. And eventually they are working their way towards blaming the Afghans for the failure that we are experiencing in Afghanistan. And that's, we don't want to get to that point, because then there will be a quick exit, and we don't want a quick exit. You're absolutely right. It has to be a slow exit. I would not mention dates either, but some dates are there. So I think that's the way I would see it. And of course, I also think that it is essential that new players that the new people who have emerged in Afghanistan over the past 10 years are brought into the discussions and into any search for a solution?
Absolutely. I fully agree with what Ambassador Vendrell said, just adding a couple of other points to it. First, number of people, analysts, are making an assumption that the Taliban, or trying to show that the Taliban are some sort of autonomous force. And very rightly, as Mr. Vendrell have pointed to, the reality shows different. Some say it's only the Taliban went and took refuge in Pakistan to just regroup and reorganize by themselves and come. But it is not. A sense of autonomy could not be given to the Taliban. The reality on ground shows, and there are indicators, the Taliban were and are either agents or hostages of the interest of some elements in Pakistan. And in some cases, recently we have seen Iran also, evidence emerged that Iran also tried to provide and support on others. So the assumptions that they could engage in war on peace or peace without the full support of Pakistan, as Mr. Ambassador said, is something not going to be matched by the reality. So what we need to see, an example, not like what has happened with Mullah Baradar, a senior Taliban player who started engaging with the Afghan government in discussion, and there were some progress in the talk with him, but the discussion and the entire process were aborted very immediately after the Pakistani inter-service intelligence have just arrested the guy. And in the past, Pakistanis were saying, we don't know him, we don't know where these guys are. But once the negotiation independently started and proceeded, the guy was arrested and now he is in the custody. That is an important indicator, a number of others, that the Taliban are and cannot be a force of having their own autonomy. And in terms of those who feel that Afghanistan does not deserve democracy, these kind of thinking I can already see when I was visiting people in Washington and other places. So let them develop their own way. Or in Kabul, some senior diplomats say, what if we give one part of the country to Taliban and have two systems of laws, one under Sharia law in the south and southeast, and another one under the new under the constitution. These are very simplistic analysis of the situation. It was the same about the Middle East, North Africa. They are not about democracy. Look what is happening. The same is about Afghanistan. And I always give this example. And in my entire life, I have not seen my people standing on queues and lining up, but on election days. And that is an indication that those people are wanting a democratic system and process.
Ambassador Vendrell, you, in your opening remarks, you talked about what price the Afghans, who so badly want and deserve peace, but what price they're willing to pay for it. And I think the report suggests that the one area is going to be human rights, that the rights in the Constitution are going to be an area of contention in the talks. And I wanted to kind of draw you out. I mean, do you think that the price for peace could be women's rights? And Nader, you know, you talk from a perspective of, I think you were talking about people with whom you identify, like forces of moderation. But in the question of defensive rights, you don't seem very moderate. And somebody sitting in the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, I wouldn't expect you to be moderate. But if there were talks, it didn't sound as if I heard any readiness to compromise on this subject. So if this is going to be one of the sticking points, I'd like each of you to kind of think about how we resolve it.
Well, I would have thought I would read what the report says in a slightly different light. What the report, I think, intends to say is that there will be, amongst the issues in the agenda, issues that may impact negatively or positively on human rights and women's rights. It doesn't say, and it would certainly did not mean to say, that these issues, while they may well be a bone of discussion, that they need to be resolved simply on the basis of who has the greatest weight. I think military weight. I think it certainly doesn't mean it. I would have been perhaps a little bit clearer in saying that we must ensure, as another very well said, we must ensure that there were some gains of the last 10 years in terms of political freedoms, in terms of representative government, even though there were many imperfections. There were gains, particularly on women's rights. And we would hope two things. One is we should make sure that there are Afghans yet at the table, ready to support these gains, number one. And two, and that would have been said clearly too, that the Western countries will demand that these gains not be squandered.
Those issues are, I can't be generous on something that's not going out of only my pocket.
Yeah.
It's going to go out of everybody's pocket, so I can't be generous on that part. So when I travel throughout the country, I hear from people in those places as remote and as disconnected, like Uruzgan, very far, and the villages, or in places like in Bamiyan Dikundi, or in any other part of the south of Pakistan. When I hear people time and again echo the same issues, that we want to be able to speak and speak without fear. We want our girls to go to school. And one of the changes that they value very much in the last 9 years, they consider those issues. Then I am not in a position to say, okay, let's give up with those things. Because people do see very clearly a direct link between a longer-term stability and a political order that is inclusive if these rights and freedoms are being protected. So I can't be on that side saying that let's send back women back to their home and have the Taliban to come. What it would not be possible is because now Afghan women are not single voices, individual voices. They are collective voices that they are acting, if not in a very full-fledged, very strategic women rights movement, but they work as kind of a women rights movement. And they raise their voice and they would not accept it.